So yes, thanks, Nicola. As she says, I'm a graduate of UCT's English department, and from that list that she gave you of my interests, I'm very much interested in non-realist fiction of various kinds, and particularly in narrative shape. So I do a lot of work with genre. And these lectures for summer school have come out of my interest in Gothic, and I've taught Gothic in undergrad, Victorian and earlier, and my interest in symbolic genres generally. The idea of symbol and the power of symbol to get ideas across. Of course, it does mean I spend an awful lot of my life in popular genres, which is also enormously entertaining. So I hope that you're entertained by it as much as I am. So what sparked these lectures off? Okay, what sparked these lectures off primarily is that I hate Twilight. And it's a really nice opportunity for me to try and explain and come up with a theory to explain what Twilight is all about, why there is this frenzy about vampires, and why what it's doing is actually, in some ways, profoundly flawed and a very limited use of the symbol. So in order to do that, I'm kind of going right back to the beginning. I'm looking at what the symbol is, where it comes from, and then I'm taking it through, effectively, 2.5 centuries, from folklore into the 19th century, which is where we kind of, the symbol was set, all of the sort of aspects of it that we're used to seeing, and then into the 20th century with film and television and some literary versions of it, and then into the contemporary vampires, where they just, the quotes on here, there once was a time when vampires were as common as leaves, is a very common recurring opening to folkloric tales of vampires. And it just amused me because, hell, there once was a time when vampires were as common as leaves, but now, really. I mean, they're everywhere. They're in all our pop culture. They're really, really popular, well-known, successful in media and film society in the sense that TV series and films about vampires make a lot of money. So basically that's what I'm going to try and do over these three lectures is to look at the origin of the symbol and the development of the symbol across a kind of a necessarily very sampled set of texts, because the other thing about vampires being as common as leaves is that trying to explain them in three lectures is enormously, enormously impossible. So we just have to jump around and hope it works. So, I mean, we all know what a vampire is. The really interesting thing about dealing with the symbol, it's a cliche. In our day and age, it has this huge power of familiarity. Even the variations on vampires that we see, which are not quite doing the expected things, they're relying on our familiarity with the symbol to interact with the new symbol that's doing completely different things. So they have a lot of points in common, even the ones that have been reshaped. A vampire is a monster in human form. It's more often male than female in most of the texts that we come across. They can be either, but for various reasons, male ones are much more common. And its basic characteristic is that it is both undead and undying. That is, it has this bizarre relationship with life. It is not alive, but nonetheless, it moves around. It is undead. So it's a very transgressive figure. It crosses the boundaries of death. It's both horrifying and appealing because it gives us immortality, it gives us an image of immortality, even though it is this deeply unnatural immortality. It also, in a sense, relies for this immortality on the primary aspect of the vampire, which is that it drinks blood. It feasts on the blood of the living, basically, and it has its ability to reproduce itself, either through the bite or through the transfer of its own blood. So we are presented with unnatural life, unnatural nourishment, and unnatural reproduction. It's almost in a way an anti-symbol for life. And it's like all of the really greatest monsters, like Frankenstein's monster, like zombies, like shape-shifting aliens or whatever, it's the more horrifying because it's so close to us. It is sometimes indistinguishable from us. You can't tell a vampire in quite a lot of contexts until you put it to these various tests. It looks like a human. So because of that, because it is sometimes indistinguishable from us, it has the power to externalize our own fears and anxieties about ourselves. And hence the title of these lectures, The Vampires We Deserve. I'm suggesting that this is an enormously shifting symbol, that at any point in history or culture, what it manages to do is to both embody and to perpetuate the preoccupations of its time and place. So we create the vampires we need and want at any one point in time. And that process is enormously revealing about ourselves. In a sense, we deserve Edward, we made him. So I'm going to go back and look at the origins of vampires very briefly. Again, this is a huge topic. And the quote there is from Terry Pratchett, whose Carpe Jugulum I thoroughly recommend as a very, very funny and acute Discworld novel that unwraps in umpteen ways the and pokes enormous fun at the stereotype of the vampire. So vampires are everywhere. Most cultures, quite a lot of cultures, have some sort of idea of a vampire. The vampire that we're familiar with in most of our contemporary Western literature is the one that that comes from Eastern Europe, particularly. Occurs in the folklore of Romania, Hungary, Transylvania, etc. So it's a very specific flavor of vampire, but as that quote suggests, I mean, he's talking about Discworld, but that's absolutely true. There is a culture that believes in vampire watermelons or squash. They're not particularly worrying vampires. They kind of gnaw your ankles, and you don't take them very seriously, but they come out at night, and they tend to drink the blood of the living. You get vampires that are animals or beasts in form that feed on animals, the chupacabra in South America, for example. So they're very, and we have African vampires. The Mpundulu, the lightning bird, one of its attributes is that it's supposed to drink blood. So that it's a very, very pervasive motif. The roots of the word vampire are unclear. It's one of the things that critics love to have these little debates about. Different theories make it Serbian, Turkish, Slavic, classical Greek. It turns up, one of the earliest places it turns up is in the written accounts of 17th century Poland and Russia, where it describes the perfectly literal, factual, as far as they're concerned, incidences of vampirism in rural villages. So its origin is in the genuine belief, effectively, of the peasantry, of the agricultural people. And it relies very much, the construction of the symbol is very much about their fears of and their ignorance about the processes of death. It also reflects a life that was hard, where death was very common. Disease, death, hardship are very much a part of life. So there's this kind of almost unhealthy focus on death as a sort of a trope in life. So the folkloric form is actually quite different to the modern vampire. So the folkloric vampire pre the 19th century has a whole bunch of aspects that are really nothing like the modern vampire. The Victorians got hold of the folkloric thing and they transformed it. So pre-Victorians, the folkloric vampire is definitely not attractive or sexy. It's got some elements that make it akin to a zombie more than a vampire. It's a peasant who dies under weird circumstances and rises from the grave. And what he, mostly he, sometimes she, but mostly he, mostly what the unliving vampire will do is to prey on its own family. It'll come back into the village and it will consume, kill, drink the blood of its wife, children, you know, cousins, whatever. So in a sense, it encapsulates, among other things, almost a fear of epidemics, the kind of disease that hits an entire family and takes everybody out. It's very much a symbol that is about predatory killing and about this deep, deep unnaturalness. It has very religious associations, obviously, because as soon as you are transgressing those borders between life and death, you're moving into the realm of religion. Technically, religion believes it has the monopoly on eternal life. And the way you're supposed to get it is not, gosh, by drinking the blood of the living. You know, it's by being very Christian or whatever and doing the right things that get you into heaven or paradise or whatever thereafter. So it's this unnaturalness is the antithesis of the Christian version of eternal life. And quite a lot of early folkloric versions of the vampire are based on the belief that a vampire arises because the spirit has not departed from it. Somebody has died, but the spirit is still inhabiting the body in this weird, unnatural way. The body doesn't decompose, and it later rises and shambles into the village and starts eating its relatives. and there are dozens, if not hundreds, of different superstitions about what it is that causes a vampire to rise. Weird things. Cat jumps over your coffin, you will rise as a vampire. You know, if you don't eat garlic in life, you will rise as a vampire. Something about eating garlic means that you are actually safe from rising as a vampire once you've died. You can be born a vampire. Children born with a call can become vampires. There are all sorts of rituals you go through to stop your child has been born with a call from turning into a vampire. And quite, I think, importantly, suicides in particular are at risk of becoming a vampire. You kill yourself. If you're not buried and there are various different versions of it, buried at a crossroads with a stake in your heart. Some of the folkloric versions don't use stakes, interestingly, use rusty nails. Rusty nails through the eyes will stop you from rising as a vampire if you commit suicide. And that, of course, speaks to the idea once more of an unnatural affinity with death. Someone who commits suicide is seeking death. They have a relationship with it which is not the rejection that most normal, healthy people would have of the idea of death. So this is particularly interesting to me about the folkloric vampire is that it has this family focus. It comes back primarily to eat its own relatives. Okay, you do occasionally get a folkloric story of a vampire who comes back to haunt a lover, a woman who has a vampire lover who kind of visits her at night and nibbles on her a bit and kills lots of people around her and all the rest of it. But it's comparatively rare. The idea of a vampire as a sexualized interaction doesn't actually feature very firmly in the folklore. so it's in a sense almost a perverse interpretation of the idea of blood. A vampire needs blood, it goes for blood relatives. Once again, there's that sense of kinship. It also relates, I think, to the religious content, the idea of blood in Christian mythology and what it actually stands for. And there's always been this very strong religious association with vampires. Certain saint days, for example, banish vampires. You can't rise on particular saint days. Other saint days, however, encourage them for some reason. But within this religious association, it's also interesting that there are some pagan connotations. I mean, we all know you repel a vampire with crosses or holy water or consecrated host or what have you. But you also repel them with garlic and you stick a wooden stake through their heart, if you're not using rusty nails. And this is much more about pagan ideas of religion. This is much more about green, growing things. It reflects peasant ideologies. In Romania, there's a form of vampire that eats the moon during eclipses. That's why the moon bleeds. Being noshed by vampires. It's a wonderful, very pagan, very interesting folkloric theory. So all of this sort of folkloric aspect of vampires is kicking around through the 19th century. It's being collected in accounts of people about, you know, what we do about the peasants who will insist on burying their dead at crossroads. It's being collected by folklorists who are starting to write down the oral traditions of these peasant countries. So when the 19th century comes to get its hands on it, it has a lot to work with. Now, what really, I think, makes vampire leap madly into the 19th century with its fangs out is Gothic literature. End of the 18th century, beginning of the 19th century, was the heyday of the Gothic literature sort of genre. And we were discussing this earlier before some of you came in. This is the genre that is pilloried by Jane Austen in Northanger Abbey. It's this very female-based, often female-written, pulp popular fiction genre that has, I think, as its best parallel your average contemporary horror movie. The kind of thing you go and see because you enjoy being frightened. It's what a Gothic novel does. so it has very strong idea of terror, the titillation of terror, the excitement of terror. It has strong links, looking at the end of the 18th century to the beginning of the 19th century, it has strong links with romantic poetry, which also, of course, celebrated emotion, although in a much less excessive way. And it has a very interesting ability to reflect, because it has the strongly female readership and quite a lot of female writers, we're talking Anne Radcliffe, Clara Reeve, with those sort of great pulp, multi-volume Gothic writers. It has an ability to, in a sense, represent an exaggerated and parodic version of society as it's experienced by women. What the vampire as a symbol tends to do is to present perverse hypermasculinity. And in a way that, because it is, in a sense, rendered monstrous, is quite an interesting commentary for 19th century women, 18th century women who are fairly repressed at this point. It's also an interesting parallel with Twilight. Twilight, the contemporary series, has an enormously female readership. It is doing, in a sense, for its readers, pretty much the same thing that Anne Radcliffe or Clara Reeve were doing to their readers in the late 18th century. Gothic is enormously good fun to read. Most of it's very badly written, but it's still enormously good fun to read. It's your sort of classic adventure horror story that features innocent damsels, usually captured by wicked uncles, who hoy them off to castles in the Alps, and they have to fight off bandits, and they find corpses, and there are ghosts, and demons and goodness knows what else. It's this complete sort of over-the-top collection of supernatural nonsense. It's similar to our contemporary paranormal romance genre. And the vampire fits right into this. Now, it becomes particularly inevitable almost that it's going to turn up in the early 19th century, if for no other reason, because of what's happening in the early 19th century. So we're looking particularly here at British literature. This is, of course, the time of the Industrial Revolution, the British Empire, enormous amounts of social change. Vampires are very much an icon of power. They are very often an icon of masculinity, so they externalize and in some ways expel anxieties and desires which are linked to things like changing social classes, new elites, the idea that life is changing. What a vampire as a symbol does, if nothing else, is it looks back. Vampires are ancient. They live forever. A vampire is an atavistic figure. It's kind of rooted in the past, not as in the present. So in the Victorian age, that's terribly proud of its progress and its technology and its industrial revolution and all the rest of it, the vampire is almost a backlash against that. To look back at the past, to simultaneously be fascinated by a symbol that talks about the past, and to deny its validity, to go, gosh, isn't that all superstitious ancient nonsense? We're much better than that now. Look at us, we do progress. And I think it's particularly interesting when most of the great vampire texts are actually British, they're not American, looking at vampire texts in English literature, and in English language. The great vampire texts are British because they have that association with the old world rather than the new. Vampires are very old world things. Even contemporary modern vampire texts set in America tend to put English characters left, right, and center. The other thing that I think is incredibly useful for the Victorians, as well as talking about power, is to also use the vampire to talk about sexuality, which you really weren't allowed to do in the 19th century in any sort of mainstream way. So what you had in the vampire, apart from being a figure of power, of transgression, of this kind of unnatural life, is also a symbol that very, very readily expresses eroticism, because the vampire bite is so intimate, because it deals with penetration. I mean, you can do Freud on vampire bites from here to the next week. I won't, because Freud, oh my God. But there's this very, very powerful potential for basically symbolically representing sexuality in the vampire. And in the 19th century, when you have that option in mainstream novels, you can do it laterally. Some vampire writing from the 19th century is very deeply erotic, it really is, even though what it's talking about is technically not sex. Anyway, so the first vampire text that I'm interested here is in 1819. This is John Polidori's The Vampire. Now, John Polidori was Lord Byron's physician, okay? So he's part of that completely insane, drug-addled, aristocratic, romantic poet thing where they all used to hide themselves off to the castle on the shores of Lake Geneva and take vast amounts of laudanum and hallucinate. And Polidori's The Vampire, in fact, arises out of that one such weekend when they're all telling each other ghost stories. One of the other ghost stories that arises from that weekend is Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, which is probably the best known example of that sort of supernatural story from that group of people. It was the Shelleys and Byron and Polidori and Byron's dodgy mistress, Claire, someone, I can't remember her name. So there's a bunch of them who are all telling each other stories. Now, what John Polidori does that is incredibly interesting, and as far as I can work out, he's the first person to do it, is he takes the vampire from the rural Central European village, and he refigures the vampire as an aristocratic gentleman. And this is really the first time you see this. Up until now, this is not what a vampire is. Up until now, a vampire has shambled moaning from the grave in a peasant village, and is in fact a peasant. Has not been the kind of icon of this particular kind of social and economic power that that the vampire tends to be in the 19th century. So John Polidori's The Vampire was published anonymously. People attributed it to Lord Byron forever, which was entirely wrong. In fact, it's a very loosely disguised parody of Byron and his terribly romantic appeal and his terrible womanizing tendencies. It's not very polite about Byron, if you're considering Lord Ruthven the Vampire as a Byron parallel. But effectively, Lord Ruthven is an aristocratic vampire. He's preying on foolish or innocent women. The plot revolves around young Aubrey, who's a young, wealthy young man in society, who becomes fascinated by Ruthven, works out what he is, follows him around trying to stop him from seducing and biting ladies, gets annoys him completely to the point where Ruthven basically goes out of his way to kill the woman who Aubrey's in love with, and then to trap Aubrey into a promise where he cannot reveal who Ruthven is, which means Ruthven then marries and on the wedding night kills Aubrey's sister. So you've got something of that claustrophobia of it all being about family and friendships and kind of all incestuously in together. But it's also some very, very interesting motifs that are introduced into the vampire story for the first time. As I say, number one, the aristocracy. So that whole idea of power that the vampire has becomes exaggerated and doubled by the idea of socioeconomic and class power. This is now an aristocrat with money as well as being superhumanly powerful and able to bite people and undead and all the rest of it. It's also translocation. The vampire is no longer staggering around a central European village. It's now in London society drawing rooms. It's simultaneously here but still foreign. It's a very interesting metaphor of invasion and very interestingly reflects British anxieties about their own colonial activities as the British Empire. You know, Britain's always going out there and colonizing other people. What the vampire does is to come from Central Europe and it colonizes Britain in a very profoundly worrying way if you happen to be a 19th century British Empire worshipper. Anyway. So in Polidori's version of the vampire, we have the first occurrence of this particularly strong motif that we will see in vampires for the next couple of centuries, which is that they are these terribly sexy men who bite women, which a hell of a lot of them are. Not all of them are. But that's the sort of common basis for a lot of these things. So Ruthven is interesting because he's not technically traditionally good looking. He's described as being kind of remarkable for his singularities, is Polidori's phrase. He generates a sensation of awe. He has a dead gray eye. He's this kind of creepy figure who everybody wants to know because he's so creepy. He's exciting. He's not the boring thing that they're used to. Which pretty much, I think, explains a lot of the appeal of vampires in our day and age anyway. So he has this idea of monstrosity, of otherness, of inhumanity, which is disturbing, but simultaneously attractive. And that becomes the absolutely central tension to the way that the vampire as a symbol is constructed in all of its iterations over the next 200 years. That sort of push-pull, attract-repel, exciting, dangerous. Very, very powerful, very, very powerful symbol. Sort of pleasures of violent excitement. Ruthven is described as causing violent excitement. So it moves away from the intimacy of the family and literal blood relations and into a new kind of intimacy which is romantic. Because there is this appeal to the vampire, he's attracting women. Okay. And of course, the sort of sexual content to it is inevitable given the way that the vampire bite is constructed. The symbol is ripe for this. The vampire symbol is totally about intimacy. The vampire bites in the neck. The neck is a very vulnerable, very personal area. Nobody touches your neck and it's really, really, really close to you. And of all the predatory monsters, the vampire's attack is the most restrained. It doesn't like a werewolf rip your throat out. It just bites you very discreetly and you get this terribly romantic look of two fang marks dribbling blood and, you know, it's all terribly restrained and very romanticizable. But of course, blood is also terribly intimate. It's about, the jugular is one of the main the vein, isn't it? The main vein in the neck. It's very much about life force, about the intrinsic sort of value, the necessity of blood. It's also completely phallic symbolism. As soon as you have a pair of fangs penetrating a hole, basically, you have absolutely straightforward sexual symbolism. Penetration, the exchange of fluids, the idea of reproduction, the vampire can make more vampires, the idea almost of perverse nourishment. A vampire suckles on the victim in the same way that a baby suckles on a mother. So at the same time as it's doing all the perverse sexual stuff, the vampire is also doing this perverse motherhood stuff. and of course, the particular kind of eroticism that it tends to represent is perverse, is sadomasochistic. It's about the pleasures of submission. The vampire is this terribly powerful, destructive force, which you can't help but succumb to because it is so powerful. So it encodes with that the masochistic pleasure of submission to a force that is just so powerful that you can't be held responsible. Okay, so Polidori was enormously influential. And quite a lot of the later, far better known, far better written, far more interesting 19th century vampire stories are very heavily reliant on Polidori's work, even though we don't really read it anymore. It's not really well written, it's a bit dense. difficult to dig through. I'm going to talk very briefly about Rhymer just because the, the poster is so incredibly good fun. Okay, so James Malcolm Rhymer is kicking in around about 1844. He's producing this as a serialized Penny Dreadful, which was a terrible little pulp Victorian sort of pamphlet that had all of the most shocking, bloody kind of adventure stories, crime stories, etc. So Varney the Vampire, or The Feast of Blood, was a very successful Penny Dreadful about 30 years after, 20 to 30 years after Polidori first published it. You probably can't see from there, but the little bit at the bottom there under Varney the Vampire or The Feast of Blood says a romance of exciting interest, which apparently it was. It sold vast amounts. James Malcolm Rhymer was also responsible for the Penny Dreadful that enshrined the Ballad of Sweeney Todd, the demon barber of Fleet Street. So you can see quite exactly where his particular literary value lies, shall we say. He was a schlock writer, and a very successful schlock writer. He continues the aristocratic vampire, which is now becoming more and more entrenched with each iteration of it. It's a very, very confused story, but the other reason I mention him is interesting, because unlike Lord Ruthven, who's just a bastard and kills women and revenges himself all over the show, Varney the Vampire is the first instance we have of a sympathetic vampire. He's terribly tormented in his incoherent way because the book's so badly written. He doesn't want to be what he is. He tries to escape what he is. He eventually commits suicide by flinging himself into Mount Vesuvius, which is absolutely the kind of denouement you can expect from a Penny Dreadful. But anyway, so what you're seeing here in this Penny Dreadful is the appeal of the symbol, its ability to titillate in very broad terms. It's a much, much schluckier piece of writing than Polidori. Polidori was trying for something slightly more literary, even though I don't think he pulled it off very well. But it foreshadows the very pulp nature of a lot of vampires in our contemporary societies anyway. Paranormal romance, a hell of a lot of this sheer pulp. So let us leave Varney and move on to one of the great texts of the 19th century, which is Schoden the Smooth Carmilla. Now this is a very, very interesting piece of writing. And I think it's one that Bram Stoker relied on very heavily for his text of Dracula, which is, of course, the great vampire novel of the 19th century, but it's right at the end of the 19th century. And I don't think we realize, looking at it, particularly the way it's moved into our pop culture, how heavily Stoker relied on these earlier texts. Now, Schoden the Smooth Carmilla, of course, is well known as a writer of ghost stories. He writes wonderful ghost stories. Green tea is the classic one. Kinds of hallucinations you have if you drink too much green tea. Surprisingly creepy little story. Okay. So many of his ghost stories feature a sort of doctor, anthropologist, scientist fellow called Martin Hesselius, who is the direct literary ancestor of Stoker's Van Helsing. Very much the same sort of character, very much the same sort of spread of skills. Carmilla is fascinating because, as you can see from this, it's a female vampire. It's one of the few very powerful female vampires that we have. They tend very heavily to the male because I think of the association of phallic power. And it's quite a brave gesture for Le Fanu to be writing a female vampire in the middle of the 19th century for a number of reasons. So Carmilla is this beautiful and aristocratic woman. She has a convenient carriage accident outside a castle in Styria, which allows her to move in and stay with the family who lives in the castle, which is basically a retired Austrian colonel and his daughter, Laura. And what Carmilla basically does is to become really, really close, intimate bosom friends with Laura, with lesbian subtext like you would not believe. I mean, this is an incredibly sensual piece of writing. Right in the middle of the 19th century, it is talking quite straightforwardly through the vampire symbol about lesbian attraction. So eventually, obviously, you realize that Carmilla is a vampire, that she's creating this very, very intense emotional relationship with Laura during the day, and then creeping into her bedroom at night in the form of a great big black cat quite often. She's one of the earliest shapeshifting vampires. Dracula turns into bats and wolves, Carmilla turns into a cat. But she is creeping into Laura's bedroom and biting her in the breast, on the shoulder, and drinking her blood. And of course, Laura does the classic vampire victim thing, which is to get paler and paler and paler. Eventually, the father works out what's going on, and I find this quite an interesting story because while you have all of this interesting, unbridled female passion here, you can see it in the way Carmilla has been drawn in that. This is an illustration from the original publication of Carmilla, which was in a little journal called The Blue Book, So another one in the university, I forget which. But Carmilla's kind of yearning, the whole avidness of her body, the sort of open relaxation of Laura in the bed, and the very phallic father in the background. You can see paternal authority is about to be seriously reasserted here, and eventually it is. I mean, they work out that Carmilla's a vampire, and they track her down to her happy little tomb in the nearby woods, and they stick a stake through her heart and destroy her, basically, and Laura survives, which is, you know, all happy ending. But it also picks up quite interestingly on the element of family, because it also turns out that Carmilla is a distant ancestor of Laura's mother's family. So she's essentially sought Laura out because Laura is a descendant of hers, which is a really interesting direct echo of the kind of family focus that you got on in the sort of classic folkloric vampire. So you're seeing very, very similar tropes here to Polidori and Rhymer. It's the aristocratic vampire, it's the attractive vampire, here it's attracting young ladies despite being a woman. It's very much an intimate relationship, a seduction as part of the predation. Very hippie sense of attraction, sublimated sexuality, power differential, the idea of experience versus innocence, which is a recurring feature of the vampire symbol. But most interestingly, as I say, this is a lesbian relationship, which is not common in Victorian society at all. It's not as problematical as a male homoerotic relationship, because female sexual pleasure was really not on the Victorians' radar to any great extent. They kind of didn't really believe in it. So the idea of two women being together for sexual pleasure, why? Obviously not going to mean anything. So in a sense, you kind of get away with it far more than someone like Oscar Wilde does, being openly male homosexual. But the way that this plays out, in a sense, also ends up figuring this attraction between Carmilla and Laura as perverse. It punishes it. It destroys it. It kind of allows you the titillation of these really quite sensually described interactions between the two girls. But then you're allowed to sort of restore order by Carmilla being killed and Laura presumably going off and marrying someone in the way that she really ought to. The things that apart from the femaleness here, the things that Le Fanu is introducing which are interesting, he's got a very good sense of the age of Carmilla. He speaks a lot about her history. He's one of the strongest early examples of that idea of non-human timescale and what it actually means. It becomes really important in some of the later 20th century, 21st century versions. So she's part of an ancient family. She has all the sense of history, but the idea of the ancient family also has these connotations of decadence, of kind of almost enervation. Family is dying out. She is the last very perverse kind of remnant of it. He brings in the idea of the animal, which Polidori doesn't, and which a lot of the folklore doesn't. The idea that the vampire can transform into an animal. And this obviously extends the way that the symbol is constructed in terms of otherness. It gives them extra power. It explains one of the things that starts coming in roundabout now, which is also surprisingly not found in the folklore, which is the fangs. Folkloric vampires do not have giant teeth. They just kind of wander in and bite you, presumably they gnaw at you, a lot of their teeth are quite blunt. But the idea of elongated canines is an invention, actually, of the Victorians. You see it first very strongly in Carmilla, and then Stoker picks it up a lot with sort of scientific investigation of the vampire's victims. You can see their canines are starting to elongate, therefore they must be a vampire. But it also associates the vampire with the animal, with the primitive, with the sort of atavistic. Okay. So the idea of this languorous sensual figure, the beauty and apparent youth of Carmilla, has informed female vampires ever since the Fanu's version. It's a particularly important element because of the really, really bizarre things it does to the symbolism, particularly to the Victorians. I mean, vampires are troubling because they have this kind of shifting gender and sexual identity. Any vampire that has a fang, by definition, is male, has a phallic authority. So as soon as you give the fang to a woman, what you are doing is producing a kind of a perverse, demonic female who has more power in the Victorians' eyes than she should have. Okay, so she's very right to be kind of taken down again by legitimate phallic authority, which is Laura's father and his friends with giant wooden stakes, which basically mean legitimate phallic authority getting rid of the horrible disruption to accepted order of a woman having all of this power. And more importantly, she's fine, she's biting Laura. Nobody really minds that people bite women because, you know, they're passive receptacles anyway. What happens if she bites a man? A female vampire with the fang biting a man, in a sense, feminizes the man. She makes a hole in him. So there's this enormous degree of gender identity anxiety floating around in the construction of a vampire, and in particular in a female vampire. You will see how enormously heavily the vampire bites that we look at tend towards male vampire and female victim. Female vampire and male victim, not so much. Female and female, not so much. Female and male, oh my God, just no. It tends to be interrupted. You'll see it interrupted in the stroking. So this is basically the demonic feminine. This is the kind of figure of illegitimate phallic authority that someone like George MacDonald is using in his Lilith. Lilith is the Adam's demon first wife, popularly supposed to have vampiric traits. The idea of illegitimate power, someone who wants too much power. He doesn't allow, Lefnu doesn't allow Carmilla to ever threaten a male. Interestingly, Stoker does. So we're now jumping forward to the end of the 19th century to the very, very famous vampire text, which is Bram Stoker's Dracula. This is one of the great seminal myths of our time. This book has set in our minds what a vampire is and how it works. And it's fascinating because Stoker read a lot of folklore for it, but he obviously also read, and as far as I'm concerned, quite shamelessly cribbed large chunks out of Polidori's Vampire, probably Vanni the Vampire, and certainly Carmilla. You can see Carmilla all over Stoker. So it's an enormous influential text. It's one of the few of Bram Stoker's novels, many novels, which is actually readable. He was a terrible writer. He was a theatrical manager who wrote because he didn't make enough money as a theatrical manager to actually, you know, keep going. Most of the other stuff that he's written is kind of campy horror. Most of it is practically unreadable. The one that's quite a lot of fun, if only because Ken Russell made a really entertainingly campy movie of it, it's called The Lair of the White Worm, which has snake-worshipping English aristocrats in the English countryside. And yes, quite a lot of dodginess in it. So Dracula, the story of Dracula, I think we probably all know. The aristocratic Transylvanian count who wants to buy property in Britain. He pulls Jonathan Harker out to Transylvania to sign the papers, basically imprisons him in the castle. In the castle, he is, Jonathan Harker is almost bitten by Dracula's three vampire brides, but Dracula intervenes. We'll see how this relates to what I said earlier. Dracula then returns to Britain, where he preys on Lucy Westenra, who is a friend of Jonathan's wife, Mina. He turns and kills her. He turns her into a vampire and then kills her. She rises as a vampire. He ends up trying to prey on Mina herself, but Jonathan Harker and all his friends, including Van Helsing, who is a nice doctor type, basically track Dracula down and kill him before Mina can fully become a vampire, and they effectively that way rescue her and return her to proper non-phallic, non-authority, as good Victorian women should have. So while it obviously relies very heavily on early 19th century texts, on the tropes of the Gothic novel, and on the folkloric accounts, Stoker by all accounts read a lot of the folklore. But it's interesting because it's also so much a late Victorian novel. It's one of the vampire novels that very beautifully expresses the tension between the age of the vampire and the modern world in which the vampire finds him or herself. So the way that Stoker's Dracula is constructed is a kind of cobbled together set of accounts that all together make up an overall narrative. So it's basically accounts from Jonathan, from Mina, from Lucy, letters between them. It's narratives from doctors and lawyers. It's journal. It's doctors' journals recorded onto wax tablets and then typed, which was cutting-edge technology at the time that he's writing. It's telegrams, it's newspaper articles. It's very much embedded in the now of Victorian technology. And yet it uses all this Victorian technology to tell the story about this ancient, centuries-old vampire who is, in a sense, invading the contemporary British progressive landscape with this ancientness, this primitiveness, this atavism from his Transylvanian roots. So You see quite a lot of Victorian pride in their own technological achievements shining through in this narrative. You also see the importance of science. One of the early narratives where they attempt to rationalize the vampire as scientific. What is he? How does it happen? Van Helsing goes on and on about his child's brain. They employ not only biological theories, but early psychological theories to try and explain how a vampire can think like this, be like this, how it's possible. But interestingly, despite the whole, we are Victorians and our technology is so great, science doesn't quite conquer all in Dracula. Effectively, what brings Dracula down is the good old-fashioned consecrated host, holy water, crucifixes, stakes to the heart. Fill the mouth full of garlic and cut the head off, which is the classic way of getting rid of a vampire so it doesn't come back. Or you can burn them. Folklore of vampires, you burn. Anyway. So despite the fact that the story appears to look at the vampire as this kind of carryover from the past, in a sense it's also almost nostalgic for a religious certainty that is, with the rise of things like Darwinism, is starting to escape the 19th century people. They're no longer quite as certain about their religion as they were before. So the vampire becomes this really, really interesting symbol that allows them to go, actually, yes, religion is deeply powerful. A cross does work. You know, we haven't lost it as much as Darwinism makes us think we've lost it. Obviously, this is still the aristocratic vampire. This is still the vampire who has wealth and status. Stoker puts an increasing emphasis on, and it's really the sort of seed for this for most later vampire texts, on the vampire's not only physical strength, the vampire is superhumanly strong, can also do things like run straight up walls, which is always creepy, but the idea that the vampire has mental powers, can mesmerize a victim, can enthrall them, so that you are not only totally helpless in the face of the super strong predator, you are also totally mentally helpless. Even if you could resist physically, you can't resist mentally. The vampire is the ultimate symbol before which you submit because you can't do anything else. And there's a lot of sadomasochistic pleasure kind of around that construction of the symbol. So these physical powers, this idea of this enormous power simultaneously with this primitivism and a lot of anxiety about the idea that this is a very national sense of otherness. This is the barbaric Eastern Europeans colonizing the great glorious British Empire in the reversal of the process whereby which the great glorious British Empire is colonizing everybody else. But it's this kind of fear of an invading and conquering other, as in different to themselves, which is simultaneously disturbing and terribly powerful, but also somehow inferior and almost abject, associated with the body, with sort of grotesqueness. And you see this carried out in Stoker very powerfully. The vampire is associated with marginal peoples. The vampire has gypsies, for example, as his servants. The insane are his servants. This whole idea of a symbol of otherness, of difference, of marginality, of an identity that is outside the accepted mainstream cultural identity. You see some of the modern contemporary texts doing very interesting things with that. And particularly, you see the vampire as the site of these unbelievable gender confusions. Because of this fang that has this phallic power quite separate from the actual identity of the vampire who has the fang, basically. The term that a lot of critics use about a vampire is drawn from Freudian theory. They talk about a vampire's polymorphous perversity, which basically is the Freudian term for the shifting ideas of sexual gratification and sexual identity that very young children have before they've kind of settled on any one particular one. So you have in the vampire, particularly in Stoker's vampire, I mean, Stoker's Dracula is a very compelling figure. He's not entirely good looking, but he's well dressed. He's dressed like a gentleman. He has this kind of charismatic compulsion to him. He describes having very pointy ears and being very white. But otherwise, he's described as an old man. He kind of looks a strange combination of normal and slightly freaky. But within this, he's a hyper-masculinized symbol. He has all of these powers of strength, of domination, of mental domination, of penetration. But at the same time, he has three vampire brides. So early in Stoker's Dracula, there's a very interesting scene in which Jonathan Harker wanders stupidly through the castle at night and goes to sleep in a sofa somewhere where he shouldn't. And these three vampire brides come in and kind of gloat over him for a bit and start being about to bite him. In this incredibly problematical moment for the Victorian of all of these women with phallic power about to feminize this poor masculine character. And Dracula actually intervenes at the point where these women have got him and have got Harker enthralled. He's lying there in this kind of dreamy way going, you know, gosh, oh, beautiful woman, and not being able to think much beyond that. Dracula himself, in a rage, kind of intervenes and stops them. So generally speaking, throughout the book, the kind of biting that you see is Dracula himself biting women. He bites Lucy and Mina. Or you see Lucy, once she's turned into a vampire, biting children. So she becomes a perverse maternal figure rather than a perverse sexual figure. She tries to bite her fiancé, but fortunately Van Helsing intervenes. So she's a sexualized figure and therefore illegitimate and punished and becomes a vampire. But she also becomes this perverse maternal figure who tries to bite children rather than biting men or other women. And that very much allows this perversity of the vampire to remain within accepted Victorian channels. So they're using it to talk about sexuality, but they're not using it to talk about sexuality in a way that transgresses beyond a certain point the norms of the time. and this is also, I think, this whole kind of troubling indeterminacy of the vampire is where you're starting to see, again, an element that Stoker certainly popularized. I don't know if he quite invented it. I think some of the folkloric stuff might do. A vampire can transform into mist. A vampire can become a column of mist and they can drift through a keyhole or something like that. And that is a very, very interesting image of that indeterminacy, that shifting identity, that way that you cannot pin them down as all masculine or all feminine. That the way that they transgress not just the boundaries between life and death, but gender boundaries as society tends to construct them, and Victorian gender boundaries are very, very firmly constructed. So Dracula is important, as I said, right at the end of the 19th century. It always amuses me back to yellow cover is the absolutely classic, iconic first edition of Dracula. It's yellow and red. I mean, there's a trick in the colors we would associate with a vampire these days. That one on the left is a second or third edition. It has the black and the vampire bat and looks a lot more like what we would expect, but that's actually the correct one. And it's always amusing me that Bram Stoker looks like totally dead normal, given the weird stuff he was writing about. But what he's basically done, despite being really, when you get down to it, rather a hack writer, he has, in that one novel that he's written, crystallized a symbol in such a powerful way that is so intrinsically linked to its time and became so popular as a result of it, that it's, in a sense, shaped our idea of a vampire thereafter. So what I'm going to do tomorrow night is to look at the 20th century and to look at how particularly Dracula moves into film, and then later in the century, into television. So I'll talk about things like the Bela Lugosi Dracula and Christopher Lee. I want to talk about Anne Rice, because we're now getting another version of literary Gothic moving in the middle of the 20th century. And I will finish up tomorrow by talking about Buffy, because one absolutely cannot talk about vampires and not talk about Buffy. And I have, contrary to my own expectation, finished 10 minutes early, which allows time for discussion and questions if anybody has any. Also, my voice is popped back quickly, so it's probably just stop there. Any questions, comments? In fact, while this room is confusing. Are there any other questions? No,